Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
It's not March, but the madness is beginning. Merger madness. This has been a pretty big week with a lot of interesting things happening within fintech. Now, for a long time, people have talked about, has fintech failed to achieve its lofty ambitions? Critics pointed to regulatory hurdles, challenges integrating with outdated financial service architecture, then that global credit crisis in the middle of it, not the least of which, banks themselves kind of upped their game. On today's show, we're going to talk about some things that are changing the landscape, and excited to have joining us Steve Alaka, president of Lending Club, and Mike Butler, president and CEO of Radius Bank, who in news just last week announced that Lending Club would be acquiring Radius. Now, Brett, I remember when you and I met way back when, you'd just written Banking 1.0, and now you're on 4.0.
So well, 2.0. I started
with 2.0. Was it 2.0 when it came out? Okay, so Banking 2.0. Did you ever think a time would come that we would see one of the finsurgents acquiring a traditional bank?
Of course. You know, I think the main principle behind this is as you grow, you're going to need certain artifacts of the old system to be integrated and to be ubiquitous. And so it's fairly obvious that instead of going down the path of trying to replicate something that is already there that provides the functionality you need or the regulatory compliance that you need, that you'd acquire it. The only question really was how quickly could the fintech organizations that are now doing this get to a point where they would be big enough to acquire traditional players.
Yeah. So Steve, from your perspective, what was the thesis behind buying a bank?
Well, I mean, the thesis is broad, really. I mean, it starts with enhancing and diversifying the earning potential of Lending Club's business model, but it really just starts there. I mean, it also gives us regulatory clarity by bringing us inside the regulatory environment. And, most importantly, it provides us with an ability to be able to better serve our customers who are coming to us, interestingly, really at this intersection of credit and savings, because our customers are coming to us by the millions to use a credit product to become more financially stable, right? By addressing that high interest rate, often perpetually revolving credit card debt or high interest rate auto debt. Customers are coming to us to use that credit product to actually find and accumulate savings and become more financially stable over time. So we had customers coming to us and asking for us to be able to provide them with products that actually help them to accumulate and grow their savings.
Now, I'm curious. I'm assuming it was Lending Club was out looking for a bank to acquire. So, Mike, what went through your head when they arrived and came knocking on your door and, a traditional player that is, kind of said, hey, we're reinventing banking, saying, hey, we actually want to not just partner with a bank, but acquire a bank?
Yeah, well, I would tell you that I've been with Brett all along, that I felt like there was going to be something that I refer to as the rebundling of financial services. I think the fintech industry proved to the banking industry that a lot of our products and experiences that we deliver clients are a little bit subpar, and that somebody else has, by being outside the industry, you can do it a little bit better. But I also felt always that there was going to be this rebundling whereby, forward-looking banks like us would partner with fintechs. I would also say that in our particular case, I think the work that we had done building this kind of national digital DDA deposit gathering was not something that a lot of banks were comfortable with as a part of the future. And we did know that companies like Lending Club would be very interested in it. So not a surprise at all. And frankly, one that we had talked about in the boardroom. And so it was a welcome conversation with Scott as we talked about what this opportunity could bring.
I think, you know, when you look at the growth of LendingClub, you know, you started off with obviously with the lending, and then you got into sort of more of the savings component of it from a product perspective. But was part of sort of the depth of the, you know, the sort of product range part of the conversation?
Yeah, this is Steve. Absolutely. I mean, in fact, the relationship started by your reaching out to Radius in the form of a partnership for the banking as a service offering. We were looking to provide a savings experience for our customers who are coming to us, like I said earlier, to use a credit product to effectively find savings. So that's kind of how the relationship even came to be. Running parallel to the path of our looking at a bank charter through both de novo and acquisition paths.
Now, Steve, you know, when you looked at sort of integration, you know, one of the things that Radius has got a good brand for is their sort of technical competency, their tech stack. You know, in terms of gluing these two entities together, how much of a consideration was that sort of technology that will allow you to combine the two offerings?
Yeah, I mean, Radius really stood out from amongst all the, you look at the thousands of banks that are out there. There really aren't that many. There's really only about 13 digital banks that feature a national footprint with no legacy branch network and a culture of innovation and the modular technology infrastructure that you're describing. So that's why, you know, Radius clearly stood out there. When you look at what Mike and that team built, which is a, you know, leading deposit platform that, you know, LendingClub doesn't have at all. This is one of the reasons why we were talking to them on a banking as a service basis in a partnership even before any combination talks happened. And, you know, we focused our platform on the lending side. So very, very much a core part of the consideration that led us down this path.
Now, Mike, you know, when you guys invested heavily in that sort of technology play, and obviously you're one of the more, you know, mature from a digital perspective in terms of banks in the US, but were you envisaging, you know, when you built out this tech stack, partnerships like this one with LendingClub?
Well, frankly, you know, what we like to say is that we were very focused on what our core business plan was, and that, You know, if you think about the simple part of what our plan was, is how do you replace the traditional branch network as a place to acquire and serve retail DDA customers, right? So we see that kind of store model changing fairly dramatically as others like you see it. And our job was to create that Amazon-like experience that we knew that clientele would demand. I mean, we are really late to the game, I would say, as it relates to e-commerce experiences and even marketing. So our objective was to get a leading start on that for our direct-to-consumer and direct-to-small business clients. And from that, we knew if we could do that very well, other things like banking as a service would be a natural outgrowth for us. And then obviously, I think our belief in support and embracing of the fintech model would kind of make it a natural that something like this would be a more than just a banking as a service partnership, if that makes sense to you.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And so as you've talked about the original plan for Radius, and you both talked about, you know, customers have been asking for this, it opens up new avenues. When you think about the combined new plan and the everywhere you could go, what's the big vision you want to provide customers? And Steve, why don't we start with you? And then Mike, I think this is an important one. So to hear from both of you would be really good.
Sure. I mean, in most simplistic terms, we want to provide an integrated customer experience that enables consumers to both pay less when borrowing and earn more when saving.
I love the simplicity of that, of the pay less and earn more, you know, does go very well together. So, Mike, from your perspective, what would you add on to that about the big vision?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the psychographic of this client base, that the technophile kind of description of what we've got is that people who have chosen to do their banking and financial services digitally, through their, you know, devices, make this a really interesting kind of opportunity for the two of us. We have clients that have made that decision to do that and now are going to avail themselves of two award-winning products, one on the loan side, one on the deposit side. That's going to come with not just the product, but the experience that's being demanded out there by the client. And I think that that's the one thing I don't want to downplay. You know, your experience getting a loan at Lending Club is award-winning. You know, the experience here with, you know, our online bank and our deposit opening is obviously award-winning. And that's what the client's going to get. And I think it's going to change the way the expectations of clients are when it comes to getting financial services.
Now, hey, Mike, you know, you spoke about technophiles, which obviously all of us on this call probably consider ourselves in that space. And you also spoke about replacing the branch functionality and that sort of purposeful deployment of technology to give that level of service and capability and reach to the customers that wouldn't make them feel like they were missing something because they didn't have branch access, which I think is great. It's critical. But do you think that because of that approach, from a design perspective, that Radius's customers are more engaged on digital than an average bank?
Well, you know, Brent, I think that they eventually will be, but today I can tell you the profile of our customer is at the branch level.
So pretty normal average, yeah. Debit customers.
Yeah, well, obviously huge, you know, online users. I would say where the engagement comes a little bit more is on the customer service side. I mean, you would be, you wouldn't be, but most people would be surprised by the number of interactions that we have with our clients that are really not just, I forgot my account number, but interactions like, I like the way your online banking looks. You know, I appreciate what you do for me. I mean, there's also I don't like things. So it's a very discerning client base in which there's more interaction, which I think would lead to a deeper relationship over time.
Great. Thanks.
I'm curious where those interactions are coming from. Are a lot of them outbound or are they inbound, or is it a mix across all of the different channels that you can engage with customers?
Well, again, I'll go first. Steve probably has his own views there, but we have a lot of inbound, through our customer service and our chat and, all the ways that we're now designed to talk with people. So much more of it is inbound, from our perspective. And, we've targeted a very high NPS score, especially for an e-commerce company. But, we commanded over 50 on the NPS side of it. So there's a lot of good communication that goes on.
And Steve, from your perspective, are you seeing a similar mix of engagement from Lending Club? I think historically, at least the banking side like to think that for a lot of these online driven lending platforms, it was a more transactional type of relationship. Is that true? And does this start to change that?
100%. Yeah. I mean, Lending Club initially, when you think about the customer's interaction, it's fairly transactional in nature. A customer would come and get a personal loan most often to try to tackle high interest rate credit card debt. They'd set up automatic payment almost exclusively, and then it wouldn't have a lot of occasion to be able to interact with Lending Club. We shifted our focus a little over a year ago to focus more on a membership experience over time, focused on that core use case of a customer who's coming effectively to use a credit product to find and accumulate savings and achieve more financial stability and therefore achieve better terms on a future credit relationship. So when you think about that use case evolving just on the lending side and how it intersects with a customer's deposit relationship, because they actually are using this particular credit product to find and accumulate savings, we think it really gives us a unique opportunity to connect with customers in a way that's a different level of engagement, frankly, than even what's been imagined today when you look at how most customers are interacting with that transactional demand deposit account.
Can I just jump in here, Steve, and you know, Mike, you may have some comments as well, but with the emergence of more of that sort of subscription style things, we've had a lot of discussion about Amazon Prime type of models for banking. We've seen some of the challenger banks like Revolut and Monzo trying this stuff as well with a sort of a premium offering where credit is closely tied to that. What do you guys think about that concept of the combined entity that, you know, it looks more like a, you know, Amazon Prime for access to savings and credit than, you know, a traditional bank? Is that sort of how you guys are thinking a bit about the future model?
Well, I'll start, and Michael have plenty to add on top. But you know, from my perspective, most neobanks are really focused on cash accounts and debit cards. Most neobanks are really not focused on, nor are they capable of lending at scale with transparency and fairness and simplicity. So customers clearly understand how, as they're progressing along a path of increasing their financial stability by finding and accumulating more savings, increasing their ability to pay, that translates to their creditworthiness and therefore the availability and pricing of credit. I don't think anybody really has owned that space. And when I think about in a world that's increasingly marked by the rapidly increasing digitization of money and payments, to me, the core value that a bank provides to consumers is evolving as well, from one that was historically security in a world where money was paper and metal based. So banks built these big fortress looking branches and steel vaults to convey that your money is safe when it's here. As money and payments moves digital, that becomes less relevant. Banks shifted to convenience, want to give you convenient access to be able to transact with your money. And again, as money moves from paper and metal to paper and plastic and increasingly to digital, convenience becomes increasingly less relevant as a way for banks to really provide
more
value.
Utility, right?
Yeah, right. So when I think of what's left, if not security and not convenience, then you know, what do you really expect to get from your interaction with a bank who's expected to know you? To me, the bank's got the money to lend, and when and if you need to borrow it, you want to understand that the bank is going to know you as a human being and be able to translate the terms on which they lend their money to you in ways that make sense, and that a bank's aligned with your own journey to become more creditworthy, to become more financially stable and have a better ability to pay over time as you do a good job making smart decisions about your money and finding and accumulating savings, the basic building block of financial stability and ability to pay. So I think that's what we're setting up for, is a model where our business model is not at odds with our customers, but very much complementary to our customers becoming more financially successful, and will usher in a new era of how consumers engage with a banking institution that actually is set up to be totally aligned with their journey to not only increase their financial health, their financial stability, financial success, and their ability to pay, but then translate that back in terms of their borrowing or lending relationship, which I think is going to be as money increasingly becomes more digital. I think that's the value that banks are going to have to own when security and convenience become increasingly less relevant.
No, and I do appreciate the fact that you guys have been very data-driven in respect to that stuff as well. I remember Scott on Breaking Banks, it must be 5-6 years ago now, Scott Sanborn talking about just like a single data point, you know, whether people paid their phone bill on time gave you guys you know, much better understanding of credit behavior than just looking at credit scores as an example. You know, when we look at the Chinese experience on this front as well, the likes of Alipay and WeChat, these guys are highly trusted and have become at scale big providers of credit and so forth, but primarily not built off those traditional metrics of having the branch or the metal safe or the plastic card, because they don't have any of those artifacts, but purely on the basis that they deliver every time in real time based on, you know, strong understanding of customer behavior, which is a big differentiator there. We're still a little behind the Chinese market in the respect to sort of mobile wallets and purses, but undoubtedly as we increasingly rely on that sort of digital value store, you know, the behavioral element becomes much more critical from a unique selling proposition perspective.
Yeah, one of the CEOs of our Alliance of Community Banks described it really well, talking about, Steve, your idea of security is they view data as something to be locked up in the vault, that traditionally banks have not done a great job of realizing this is a huge asset to be utilized and therefore miss a lot of that value proposition you just described. And you both mentioned this idea of being more e-commerce-like in your approach, and that certainly is what Alipay and a lot of those in China have approached it. How are you thinking about, you know, what's next? Now that you potentially have this combination, how do you think about what's next on that e-commerce level?
Yeah, you know, let me throw a couple of thoughts out, Steve, and then I'll turn it over to you. But I think, Brett, what you know you talked about is kind of interesting, and that is that subscription type of banking. And I simplify that by kind of echoing a little bit of more Steve's thoughts on what was just said on data. And I think the term I use is more personalization, right? So somewhere along this journey, the access to the data that we have, that LendingClub has, should give us a huge leap forward in this personalization side of it and be able to deliver, like, you know, I don't know if subscription and banking is what everybody wants, but surely trying to find the slices and dices of people based on their behaviors and their preferences and deliver them what they want in real time, even sometimes before they know it, would be an objective, I think, of the company from data and from what we'll see in these clients. And, you know, I'd probably enhance some of Steve's comments earlier on and maybe what Brett was saying, but insights into both lending and depository behaviors, just like, it's not 1 + 1 = 2. That's a 1 + 1 = 10 perspective of how much more we'll know about clients and able to deliver some of that. So while I think that, you know, one of the beauties of the combination is that we have a outstanding starting point. We have an outstanding path to a incredibly high level of profitability, as well as ability to deliver great products to consumers, and also a bit of a whiteboard to be able to kind of dive into what we think could be next, which over time the data and our clients will tell us.
Well, so speaking of paths, something that could be a little rock in the path to stub your toe on happens to be those regulators in that section of it. Steve, as your team was looking at this transaction, how did they approach the regulators themselves, if you can share, and how are you thinking more broadly about the regulatory path?
You're not endorsing kicking regulators, are you, Jason?
No, not kicking. I said stub their toe.
Stumbling over them.
All right. So if the OCC and the FDIC are listening right now, I absolutely did not say that.
Sorry. Over to you guys.
No, so this is something that, to me, it was inevitable that LendingClub doing, you know, last year $12 billion personal loan origination volume in partnership with a third-party bank would inevitably come inside the regulatory system, be directly regulated. I think that makes LendingClub stronger. I think that makes the system stronger when you look at our scale and our ambitions to be able to deliver more value to consumers along the lines of what Mike and I have described, the intersection of deposit and credit. So we've been in conversations with the regulators, the OCC, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve for more than a year on this path of evaluating both a de novo charter application and evaluating an acquisition or a bank merger. And like I said, this combination that we eventually landed on to combine with Radius really stood out head and shoulders above any other alternative for all the reasons that we mentioned earlier. But we're excited over the next 12 to 15 months to continue that journey and hopefully receive all the regulatory approvals that are needed.
Great. Mike, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say from LendingClub's perspective, I think most people would be surprised at the amount of regulatory oversight they already have,
right,
because of a variety of their activities, which which I think is really important. I think the ability for a fintech and a bank to come together with a bank that does digital deposit gathering, which is one of the key parts of the combined company that's in place and well regarded by the regulators, makes this, you know, an even better combination from that perspective. And the final thing I would say is really, I think the regulators are poised to want to participate in this. They've all announced their offices of innovation over the last 2 to 3 years. I think all of them have been working hard to understand the future of the industry to want to find a way to be a part of it. And so I'm incredibly optimistic and confident about what the next 9 months brings with the regulators.
So this is an important question. You guys have already spoken about the fact that this has been a journey. You know, Mike, you just said you've been working on this for over 12 months with the regulators alone. So how are the teams gelling? How is the two cultures of a fintech lending club and a digital bank? How are those two worlds coming together from a culture and a management perspective? Maybe Scott, you want to start, or?
Steve, yeah, sure. I can start.
Sorry,
probably
Steve,
by
Steve.
Saying that. No, that's okay. You're going to mistake me with somebody, it might as well be Scott. The two companies really haven't come together and gelled yet. I mean, the two companies really and are going to continue to operate very much the way we've been operating to date. I think that's the first piece. But the other piece, I'll let Mike expand on this, is, you know, I certainly don't view Radius as a typical bank by any means. I view it more like a fintech with a bank charter. I think that's one of the really unique things that Mike and team have built there. So we would anticipate, from the extent that we have just begun to work together on this journey, the cultural similarities far outweigh any sort of differences. We're in many ways a large fintech that operates, like Mike said, in a way that's already highly, although not directly regulated, and with many of the controls in place that a regulated bank would have, and a lot of the culture that a regulated bank would have. And that's combining with a company that really is, like I said, more of a, from my perspective, more of a fintech that happens to have a bank charter.
Well, parting shot for both of you. And Steve, let's start with you. What did your peers say, right? You're part of the Finsurgents, as Matt Harris likes to coin it, out there to disrupt banking. And here you go, and you've just gotten in bed with what some might perceive as the enemy. Did anyone call you and say, what were you guys thinking?
Actually, no. No, I just the opposite. I think, and maybe it's just from my perspective, because this has been such a journey, and to me, so inevitable that we would be at this point. That, no, it's been just the opposite. I think the overwhelming response from people was, you know, wow, this makes so much sense. What are the next, who are going to be the fast followers? Who's going to be the next one to try to follow in the same path?
And what about you, Mike? You haven't been kicked out of any of the bankers' clubs. They haven't come and taken away your lapel pin yet or any of that?
Well, to be honest with you, they kicked me out about 2 years ago when they saw where we were going. So this is, I think we're a bit of a leader, both of us, in this. And I think most of the people are encouraged by it and like this deal, just like all the analysts. We love it. Surely you've got a couple of naysayers, but really, I would say the overwhelming majority of the response has been, you know, outstanding move. Look forward to the transformation part of it, and good luck. I mean, I really think everybody is looking to see how this comes together. We feel like we're a very strong cultural connection. We feel like this is something that the regulators will, you know, readily approve, and that the business model is going to kind of create the foundation for what the continuing evolution of the industry will be. So a lot of support from my peers.
That's awesome. Hey, Mike, I will just give you a little bit of fintech advice, man. Your profile picture on your LinkedIn page, do one without the tie, dude.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what? It's been a long time since I've worn a tie. So
exactly.
I'm in.
Exactly.
I'm in. Okay. Well said. Touche. Yeah.
And all go right. Get a hoodie. You know, Radius needs to issue hoodies.
I don't wear a hoodie, so I wouldn't say. Yeah, but that's good. Hey, guys, listen.
Well, Brett, your picture shows up here with a tie on it.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
You gotta check your own thing.
Yeah.
There you go.
LinkedIn? No.
Oh, no,
I haven't got a
Brad
tie.
Didn't call that.
I have not got a tie on my my LinkedIn page.
Well, whatever shows up on my screen
here, it's a dress shirt. It's a dress shirt, and I'm talking, and I've got my microphone headset on, but it's not a. Yeah, look, dude. Yeah, no, I take great umbrage at a suggestion I wear a tie. That was great to have the Lending Club and Radius teams on talking about their merger. No doubt this is likely to be a template for many more to come. Obviously, we've seen the Plaid Visa merger. We hear whispers about Intuit and Credit Karma, which we'll be talking about after the break. But more and more of this sort of merger, you know, conglomerating, amalgamation of this ecosystem is going to happen. But more on that after the break. You're listening to Breaking Banks. You're with Jason Henricks and Brett King. We'll be right back after these words from our sponsors. Let's talk about finding freelance talent for your business or project. Finding the right freelancer can be time-consuming, frustrating, and expensive. Where do you go? How much does it cost? How can you be certain they'll deliver? Well, thanks to our newest sponsor, Fiverr, finding the right freelancer is no longer a struggle. Now, we've used Fiverr recently to do artwork and design for our Breaking Banks Europe launch, including a new logo that we designed. There's a quick turnaround, great pricing, and we were able to check the work that the freelancer had done before. So you can go to the Fiverr marketplace. You can look through hundreds of digital services that these freelancers offer, including graphic design, copywriting, web coding, film editing. You can search by service, deadline, price, reviews, and more. Take five and check out Fiverr.com, and you'll receive 10% off your first order by using our code BREAKING. It's so easy. Don't waste any more time and get the service you deserve by going to FIVERR.com, code BREAKING. That's BREAKING. Fiverr, it starts here.
BECU, Washington State's largest community credit union, has partnered with CoMotion, the University of Washington's collaborative innovation hub, to create a fintech hub in Seattle. They're currently holding a fintech incubator competition, which will award space in the CoMotion lab at Startup Hall near the UW campus, as well as membership and other benefits to the winning fintech startups. So, if you're a company in the fintech space and would like to benefit from a presence in Seattle and connections to the University of Washington, the world's most innovative public university, apply by March 20th. JP and I both teach at Pacific Coast Banking School, which is partnered with the University of Washington's Foster School of Business, and we're big fans of what they're doing. We know that connectivity to the resources at the University of Washington will really accelerate the types of things that a fintech can accomplish. So don't forget, apply by March 20th at bit.ly/BECU Fintech. That's March 20th is the application date at bit.ly. That's bit.ly/B as in Bravo, E as in Echo, C as in Credit, U as in Union, Fintech, F-I-N-T-E-C, by March 20th.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today. You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
With the Wealthfront Cash Account, you earn more interest on your money. They have one of the highest interest rates in the market at 1.78% annual percentage yield. That's 19 times more interest than the national average of 0.09%, according to FDIC.gov. It's easy and fast to get started. It only takes a dollar and a few minutes to open an account, and you can even do it right from your phone, no paperwork required. There are no fees, and your money is FDIC insured up to $1 million through their partner banks. Wealthfront's clients trust them with over $22 billion, and those clients have earned over $70 million in interest through their Wealthfront cash accounts. Wealthfront is the ideal way to manage your money. You can save, plan, invest, and get financial advice all in one place, and they make your money work harder for you. Right now, you can sign up for the Wealthfront cash account in less than 5 minutes by going to wealthfront.com/fintech. Go to wealthfront.com/fintech and start earning 19 times more interest on all your savings. That's wealthfront.com/fintech. Wealthfront is not a bank. Cash account is offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. Wealthfront conveys funds to partner banks who accept and maintain deposits, provide the interest rate, and provide FDIC insurance. The APY is subject to change.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech podcast and radio show. Before the break, we were talking with the team at Lending Club and Radius about their merger/acquisition there and what it meant for that. But of course, that's not the only event that's been happening in recent times as respects to movements in the traditional space. Not only have we had the acquisition of Plaid by Visa and announced, of course, this week, the Intuit and Credit Karma, or the acquisition of Credit Karma for $7 billion. We've also had other fintech news. We've had Varo getting their license finally. And we heard today, over the last couple of days, rather, that another funding round for the team at Revolut, another $500 million this time, at a very healthy $5.5 billion valuation. So there's still a lot happening. The real question is, of course, is how is all this activity going to change the response of various regulators and traditional players in the market? So we thought we'd bring in one of the Provoke family to join Jason and I on this discussion, and that is the host of Tech on Reg, Dara Tchaikovsky. Is that how I say it, Dara?
Tchaikovsky. So
okay.
Close.
I'm sorry.
So many syllables. It's okay.
Yes.
Well, more importantly, maiden name Shevlin, much like Ron Shevlin. So if you haven't listened to her episode of Shevlin on the Tech on Reg, it's one of my favorites.
Oh, well, no, I haven't. So I definitely will have to do that.
Yeah, there's a lot of sass and a lot of snark all at the same time.
Yes, I can imagine. So maybe I'll start off, Dara, with, you know, the U.S. has been fairly slow to get into this sort of regulatory purview where they license fintech in an exceptional manner versus other markets we've seen that happen, like in Singapore and Hong Kong, Australia, London, and the EU generally. So it would appear that by design, they want this type of consolidation, this type of activity where fintechs and incumbents are getting together. Do you think that is by design, or is it just a function of the fact that the US has been so slow to respond to fintech from a structural perspective that the players in the market have decided we're just going to get on with it?
So there may be an element of design intended, although frankly, I would think that that's a generous characterization of the speed of our regulatory regime, and including both the federal and state level regulatory regime there. Truth be told, I think that their speed at which fintech regulation has come or not come into play is really a function of a few different things. You've got the states and the feds sort of at it. You know, states want to continue to regulate the way they want to regulate. The OCC issued their attempt at a fintech charter, and they're sitting and litigating with each other.
Right.
And then while that happens, you know, it's no surprise that, you know, private market participants are going to sit back and wait to see how that shakes out. Although I do think that there's been at least one or two applications made. And then there's a function of, you know, the general dysfunction in Washington, D.C. as a whole. It's been, particularly since the midterm elections, particularly tricky to get anything done in Washington. with the House and the Senate being divided, with the challenges to the CFPB's structure and constitutionality sitting in the Supreme Court. It's really just sort of a mess. And I would hate to think that they designed that mess, but you never know.
Well, you know, one of the core issues behind the lack of embracing of the FinTech Charter, the whole OCC, versus New York Fed issue that you alluded to, the left hand suing the right hand in the case of US regulators on the FinTech Charter. One of the key issues remains the problematic structure of the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act. And so we've been talking about CRA reform for a long time, but that seems to be sort of a roadblock to further progress on the FinTech Charter.
I think that is one roadblock. I think there are traditional constitutional challenges to the notion of the OCC's authority generally to issue a charter for fintech under the National Bank Act. And then there's really, I think, more of the court of public opinion and the very, very zealous, consumer advocate groups who don't care for additional financial services to be entering the market, particularly with products that have not been tried and true tested. So there's a whole host of, I think, complex factors sort of working against the U.S. finally fully embracing, a comprehensive fintech regulatory regime. And we've seen it play out at the state level, too. There have been a handful of states that have, put together sandboxes for fintechs, but many states that have made the attempt to do it have been met with very, very, I think, direct and sort of aggressive consumer response, and the regulators just don't want to get their hands dirty with it.
So, Dara, one of the issues with the U.S. system is you do have this state versus federal regulatory environment where, you don't have coherence in terms of approach in respect to this. Whereas for markets like the EU, despite the fact that you do have some separation there, at the same time, you do have a basic coherence. You do have an understanding around standards, an agreement in terms of sort of high-level regulatory approaches. Whereas in the US, we haven't sort of seen that. It's like, we see these sort of regulators fighting between each other to see who's going to win, who's going to be the top dog to decide on the regulatory environment. Can that continue in a dynamic environment like we see today?
Well, whether it can continue or not, I think it will continue. Fortunately or unfortunately, that's how the U.S. Constitution is structured. I think that it's playing out in fintech now the same way it's played out in other highly regulated industry, that it's had the same sort of struggle with the 50-state regime versus the federal. If you think about other sort of ancillary financial services license, like the basic consumer lending licenses on a state level, debt collection, for example, they've been operating for decades and decades and decades with, 50 different jurisdictions and 50 different licenses and disparate requirements between all of those licenses. And it's been very expensive to deal with, but those industries have managed to swallow that pill and deal with it. And I think that And because of that, by the way, I think it's why when you are speaking or lobbying for a particular new set of comprehensive regulations, I think a lot of particularly state regulators sort of shrug their shoulders and say, what's your problem? These other industries have been figuring out a way to do it for so long. Just, hush and get on board.
Yeah. But, of course, the level of change we're going through in financial services right now is somewhat unprecedented. Obviously, the health industry is going to go through similar things, but it's very, very difficult to manage this level of disruptive change if you don't have that sort of internal coherence and standards. And it's sort of just left to the free market often, but we say that, and yet, you've got a number of practices in the US which would appear to be behind the rest of the world in terms of the rate of innovation. So things like the fintech charters and their ability to operate and take deposits without having a branch infrastructure or a traditional charter mechanism. The use of mobile payments, which has been slow, real-time payments, which are still not yet implemented, but we're well behind Europe and most of Asia in respect to that. So we have to really at some point ask the question, is this structure, which you say fairly is sort of defined constitutionally, is this structure appropriate for a move into the fourth industrial age, the augmented age?
I do think that at some point enough will be enough, and one can hope that where the action will be congressional action if a legitimate change wants to be made to sort of that structure. Or you can have the CFPB, once I think it gets sort of depoliticized one day, fingers crossed, and they can go back to the work that they were designed to do, exercise their rulemaking authority at the federal level with some preemption, and then, I think the market will eventually demand it. And I think it will be probably customer driven. I don't think it will be.
This was going to be my next question is, what, as someone that's sort of deep in the regulatory space, what would you anticipate if you were designing the outcome? What do you think it would look like?
If I were designing the outcome, look like many other issues, data privacy being another great example, there really, really should be a comprehensive one set of federal rules that everyone can operate under nationally. Having disparate sets of rules in different really criteria for enforcement by different state regulators is not good for consumers. It's not good for business. It's not good for consumers. And it leads to inconsistent results. And it's playing this ridiculous game of whack-a-mole. So should there be comprehensive federal legislation? 100%. Should there be one federal regulator who's in charge of it? Yes, that's sort of another delightful issue that we have to deal with too when we deal with financial services. There are four or five federal regulators that all kind of have their hand in regulating different parts of the financial services industry. So ideally, if I took my paintbrush and got to create my masterpiece, it would be one regulator, one set of rules, congressional action driven by constituents who are demanding innovative products.
So I think Jason's back with us. So, hey, Jason, you remember, Matt Harris's sort of concept of fintech being in everything.
Yeah, and others the fourth platform.
Yeah, the fourth platform.
Yep.
When you've got that and you've got these tech players playing in the space, increasingly getting involved in fintech. If you take, say, Alibaba or Tencent in China as an example, the temptation is just to say, well, they have to play by the bank's rules or the rules that we've got in place for traditional banks. But at some point, are you regulating financial institutions anymore, or are you just regulating companies that have finance, as part of their structure?
Well, and I think that becomes the important question. Do we start to regulate the activity versus the company? And Dara, I'd love your thought on this. Is really this merger madness is part of what it's precipitating now that the lines are getting blurred on, pieces of this, on what's a tech company that provides financial services versus what's a financial service company and who they're partnering with. Is that actually going to force the regulators to start to look at what Brett alluded to, which is what is the end outcome? And that should be the point of regulation, regardless of how you kind of self-identify as a company.
Like if you've got, I'll give you an example, Dara. If you've got an artificial intelligence that you use every day, like Amazon Echo, Siri, Google, whatever, and you're conversing with this on a daily basis and it's running portions of your life, including giving you financial advice, does that AI need a banking license?
So I think that it will become more and more activity driven, certainly, rather than what you've decided to call yourself. as an institution, because those lines are most definitely being blurred. And by the way, there's court precedent for that, and there's regulatory precedent for that. If you go back to sort of all of the litigation that really began in what we call sort of the true lender doctrine space, and it was really born out of sort of the tribal lending model, where everyone was trying to sort of shirk the usury caps in different states. So you had this model where you had, you know, a tribal Native American tribe sort of as the money behind. And there was this very complex structure for how to sort of then lend money, thinking that the Native American tribe was not going to be subject to usury rates. The regulators were like, and by the way, on paper, this all made sense. And you could draw the line. But at the end of the day, what the regulators ended up doing, and they ended up shutting down billions and billions of dollars with businesses, was they peeled back and they're like, we don't care what you're calling yourself. We don't care what label you've slapped on it. And honestly, we don't even care what your agreements say. They go to sort of the true nature of the transaction and figuring out who, quote unquote, the true lender was. So they did. They peeled back everything, labels be damned, and they wanted to get to the heart of the activity, who was actually engaging in the activity, and they regulated from there. That came through the court system, which is totally how we like to do it in America. God bless us. But I absolutely think there's precedent for that, and I do think it will be activity-driven. It's not going to matter one lick what you call yourself.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Jason? Well, in the first half of the show, I, you know, talked about kicking a regulator, as Brett called out. But in this case, I'm going to agree, Dara, with everything you just said. I think the regulators did the right thing, which is it doesn't matter what you call yourself for, you know, the protection, safety, and soundness of the industry, as well as more broadly, how do we protect consumers? We really have to think about, you know, what is that end activity? Now, I one of the questions I want to come back to, though, is we're almost out of time, is, you know, what do you think the real implications and ramifications are going to be of these mergers that have just been announced?
From a regulatory perspective, is that one for me?
Yeah, like is there going to be any regulatory involvement? Obviously, with the Radius acquisition, there will be direct involvement because, you know, they've been working on that for 12 months, they just told us. So, you know, supposedly everyone's on board with it, FDIC, Fed, OCC. Yeah.
But I'm even asking the next ripple, Brett, right? Like, so they've gotten them to agree on what the first ripple and when the stone hits the water. How do you think this begins to change the broader regulatory landscape where we now actually have a fintech owning a bank and the things they can do? We have a tech company buying a business that gives financial advice. You know, that's another ripple that's going to, you know, start to play out. What do you think this really signals for the industry? Because it's the first time we're moving beyond speculation about fintech or tech having access to banking license. You know, what do you think comes next as a result?
The truth be told, I don't think that there is going to be a terrible change, at least initially. So those regulated industries that were regulated will remain regulated despite who owns them now and despite what that corporate structure or cap table looks like. And what I do think it will be perhaps a very interesting learning curve and lesson for those other organizations who are not sort of used to this, that sort of level of regulatory scrutiny. Those first sets of audits, I think, are going to be fascinating. And all of this...
By fascinating, you mean painful.
That was my very diplomatic way of saying, sure, it's going to be painful. And the lawyers in the room are going to make a lot of money and they're going to have a lot of questions to answer. But really where I think this all comes to a head, it comes back to data privacy, particularly here in the U.S. I think that several of these acquisitions, when you have a situation, especially now with CCPA is in full force, you know, you've got many other states having very CCPA-like bills on the state floors. New York is a great example of that. You have all of these situations where customers gave Company A their data. Company A told them that their data was going to be used for X, Y, and Z. All of a sudden, new company now owns all of this customer data and the consents that consumers were given, that were given for what could be done and what they understood was being done with their data, I think are going to fundamentally change. And 5 years ago, that wouldn't have been a big deal. Today, it's a much bigger deal.
But I'm going to take the devil's advocate position here, Dara. And, you know, I know this is sort of the last question we're going to probably cover off. But, you know, I'm of the Jack Ma school of thought here, which is when it comes to privacy in the fourth industrial age, you know, get over it. It's like, you know, the amount of data that we collect on our citizens and that's flowing around the system, you can't possibly manage that, in any sane manner in the future. So I think and I don't know if millennials care, but, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
So I don't disagree with that on a fundamental level. It doesn't give me agita personally, but those very fancy laws were put into effect to put these, you know, regulators on the map as being, you know, the hardest, the privacy police. You know, California was first and New York can't be outdone, so they're going to be second. And without some sort of, you know, overall federal regime, whether or not consumers actually care, the regulators are going to care, because they put a lot of time, thought, and effort into putting these brand new laws on the books. And I don't see them with these brand new laws on the books just turning their heads away from those issues. So these organizations are going to have to manage that, whether it makes sense or not. By the way, I didn't say any of this had any sort of, you know, grounding in actual logic.
No, I know. Maybe we just end up with the Consumer Protection Bureau instead of a Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. But anyway, Jason, last comment.
Well, Brent, I think, you know, that is a whole other episode we should dig into, which is, you know, why do we draw these artificial boundaries between things? You know, right? If my Echo is dispensing financial advice, my refrigerator is giving me financial advice in the Internet of Things, maybe we actually need a more holistic view.
All right. Well, on that note, that's a good note to finish on. Dara, thanks for joining us on this chat.
Thank you so much for having me.
And continued success on your great podcast, Tech on Reg. If you guys haven't listened to it, that's your next piece of homework before you listen to Breaking Banks again next week. Go and check out Tech on Reg, and we'll tweet it out from the Provoke FM channel, as we always do, and also from Breaking Banks. Jason, good luck up in the mountains. Where are you?
I am at the Sundance FinTech Festival hosted by MX with our good friends, Ron Shevlin and a host of others talking about, you know, FinTechs in the mountains.
Well, say hello to the usual suspects, as they say, and our friends at MX who remain a good sponsor of the show as well. That's it for Breaking Banks this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Join us next week. We're going to be talking about, we're going to have another amazing guest on next week. We've got a lot happening in the fintech space right now. It's a very exciting time. So stay tuned to Breaking Banks and you'll be hearing all about what's happening right here as you have the last 7 years of our podcasting and radio show history. But that's it for the week. And we will join you guys next week. Don't forget to go to iTunes or Stitcher or Podcaster or Spotify, wherever it is you access Breaking Banks from. Give us a shout out and drop a 5-star rating on the show if you feel so inclined, or tweet us out. We'd really appreciate it because that's how people find out about us. And otherwise, we will see you guys on another Breaking Banks brought to you by Provoke.fm next week. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.